Zach Alcoholic.
Yeah.
Sobriety Date.
They spelled my name wrong here. I'm just going to fix that real quick.
Sobriety Date, January 23rd, 2014. I drank a Celsius on the way here. My heart is exploding out of my chest. I promise I'm not nervous. And I just found out this is being recorded. So, I'm glad there was an opener. I like that topic of service. I was thinking about when Alex was sharing that I drank for the effect that alcohol produced and other things, but my mindset was always changing the way that I feel as a kid and when I got into alcohol and other things. And really with any, I can abuse anything. And so throughout my journey, Alex kind of took me back to this, the way my mind processes it, the way my sponsor helped me process it, which was, I don't like the way that I feel, and I will naturally seek out changing the way that I feel. And the irony with service, sponsee calls, they always call at the wrong time. Like, it's never, there's times where I'm just like on the couch chilling. That's the time to call me. But it's always when I'm like thinking about something else, I'm trying to solve this problem at work. Typically when I'm disturbed, it's weird how that happens. I'm like, fuck, dude, or crap, shoot. The irony of, for me, of service work is that I have this deep-rooted uncomfortability, and I've trained my brain like a Navy SEAL to fix me as quick as I can with whatever I can find. And the irony is that, well, it sucks because it stopped working. And so that's my, you know, as I get into my story, like, that's the progression of my disease, is I'm just constantly like, how can I never had a drinking problem. I had a sober problem. And when I first heard that in the meeting, I was like, whoa. But the irony is that service work feels good. Like, when you get through it, when I pick that sponsee call up, and I go through all that, and like they're telling me all the, you know, whatever, some small problem that I'm like, what? Like, you're really bummed out about this situation. And I go into my cupboard of experience and these random experiences that I've had in AA, and I'm like, oh, this is useful. Let me deliver this to the sponsee. I forgot that cup was up there. I'm gonna give it to him. It gets me out of that crap and that feeling, and feels good. And that's kind of, Alex like took me down this whirlwind, because I'm freaking nervous, and I enjoyed that, thank you, of this, you know, there's tools in me, and that's like a tool, and it's so neat that I can achieve what I always hoped to achieve in this journey along the way. So that's my little tangent. She's giving me the wrap up, like, get to your story here. That's the beginning. I mean, I think in the moment growing up, I was just freaking miserable. There were circumstances that there were cards that I was dealt. They were better than some and worse than others. I think it was just the lot that we are delivered. And there were things that happened to me that were shitty, and things that were actually better than, you know, than I could have imagined. And I think that I was just generally not having a good time in life as an 8-year-old. You know, whatever, however early I can remember, I just straight up was not having a good time. And there was this disconnect of, like, everyone else was experiencing life, and I was just over here miserable. And any experience that I had, positive or negative, was always just like, I'm just a piece of shit, it sucks. And, you know, I don't know, I mean, it was like a lens that I was viewing the world. You know, I was a Fox News or CNN news anchor, and there's the news, but I'm interpreting it with my bias. And I just viewed life through that bias of, like, I'm not good enough, everyone's better than me, my older brothers are this, and my parents got divorced because of me, and whatever. It was just BS interpretation, but I just lived through that lens. So, like any good alcoholic, at some point I discovered that I could ingest substances to feel better, and that's what I did, and it worked great. I was lucky enough to go to rehab in high school, so junior to senior year, I went to rehab, and a prodigy child. I don't know. You know, I think about Tom Brady, and there's this quote of people I watch it on Instagram Reels, and I like Instagram better than like Facebook. I feel like there's a lower tier. TikTok's like, I don't know how the app works, but Instagram, I feel like there's like you're getting the most polished content. So that's where I digested this reel, which talked about his journey with getting uncomfortable. And I was thinking about that when I was thinking about me going to rehab at 17. It's just really getting uncomfortable. And it was actually, and I say this just to bridge the gap if anyone's gone through this, and I won't speak on it again, but it was actually for an eating disorder. So that was kind of my first taste into this wonderful life that we live. So if you're out there, male or female, and have been through that, you can come talk to me because this is single doesn't purpose. But that was my first treatment, and but then you know once we got into the substances, that's where it really got fun. And it was nice to juggle. Am I talking too loud? I feel like I've got a lisp. Like let me know because I will be right here. No, it was. It was really fun to have these different avenues to be able to get tripped up. Because I could really, you know, I at times, you know, my MO was like, whatever's going to work right now. I wasn't privileged to have access to so many things. So I would just use, like, you got duster spray. You know, you got, you know, can we go to Walgreens and get some ice cream and cereal and I'll go in the bathroom? Like, we got cough medicine. And then when I was afforded the opportunity, alcohol would have been preferred. And it kind of felt like, you know, I was like Breaking Bad, Jesse and Walter White. And it was like a science experiment. I lived my life. Once I discovered that I could use these things to change the way that I felt, it was just like tinkering with, what is it, powder he puts in there, cayenne pepper? And the, whatever. So it was like, you know, I'd had this system in this way to this routine. And it was all about elevating myself, you know, physically to a point where I was just okay. And that came first. It was like, whatever other priorities I had, dude, I got a hard schedule here. Because this kicks in, I gotta make sure I got food in my stomach so I don't get sick, and that's gonna wear off, and then I'm gonna drink this. I remember going to math class one day with like a little bottle of Captain Morgan, and I was like drinking it in math class. It was 10 a.m., but that was the routine I was on. That was the kind of schedule I was in my athletic, you know, career as an alcoholic, and grind never stops. And I know you guys in Tampa can get that because it's really important. And I remember like, I was so proud of what I was doing and where I was at. I felt like, A, I love the fact that, this example is bad, but I love the fact that I had this little, it's like Grand Theft Auto 3 when you have the cheat codes and you can like have all the ammunition and kill all the people. The game's a lot easier when you have these little cheat codes, and so there's a little bit of secrecy to like going through life and having that. What's my point? I don't know, I lost it. I was telling three stories at the same time. And it somehow brought it back to PS2. So, you know, whatever. I didn't do well in terms of like the things that I should have been doing, not well. But I would say pretty good at finding creative ways to you know, to feel better. I don't know. I'm not super smart in terms of like the big book stuff and articulating the theory and theology of AA. I just want to feel good. The problem is that I'm impatient and I don't know how. I guess I don't know how to do it. And so yeah, I'm going to rehab. 17. That didn't work. And essentially, just to like get to 8:30. Okay, just to get through. You know. Things got worse. The drugs got a little more exciting. I started drinking. Carlo Rossi was kind of a favorite. Just again to identify. But I was, you know, I don't know. Didn't do one high school, and my career from, you know, 17 to 24 was, I go to treatment, and treatment for me, I think I was so lonely that I almost viewed treatment as like a summer camp, like a boys camp, because I'd get really, you know how it is, like, you got your little deal going, and you're like, you know, you've got a good rhythm of a few months where you're really consistently knocking this alcoholism out of the park, and then you get caught. And I was a type that I'd just be like, yeah, you got me. I'd give a couple truths just to like show that I'm really transparent, and then I'd wholeheartedly agree to go to treatment. And I think a part of it was that I was like kind of aware, like, this is kind of crazy what I'm doing here, because no one else around me is doing this. But the other side was, man, I just need a break, dude. Like, rehab sounds great. In the beginning, if your parents have insurance, you go to some pretty nice places. I didn't go to Turning Point, although that was a nice one, but I went to, like, there's one in Fort Lauderdale on the beach. I did go to some treatment facilities, like Teen Challenge, would not recommend. But I, you know, just to, like, find a point here, my story was bouncing between, you know, a couple months of treatment, I would find something that I disagreed with. Essentially, I'd just get tired of being sober. And then I'd find a way to convince someone to let me go home. And then a couple months later, I'd be back in treatment. That's pretty much the nuts and bolts of everything. There was, I don't know how much I want to go into the war stories, but Jared, my buddy next to Alex, always, he has a favorite story, and then I'll kind of transition, but I'll tell the tree story. So I was going to tell the TV story, but the tree story, kind of a highlight of, you know, encapsulation, if anyone can relate, is so in the beginning, rehabs were nice, and then I started ending up in homeless shelters and kind of the freebies. So they'd make you be a Christian, and then you'd go work in their thrift store as a penance. And there'd be like some religion in there. And I bought into it, dude. Like there was times where, you know, I spoke tongues once. And there's no shame if that's your thing. Just for me, it was like a really interesting experience. And there were moments where I was like, this could work. And I got kicked out, unfortunately, for excessive drug use in one of these homeless shelters. And I walked to the closest building that I could find, which happened to be the community library. And I don't know how I transitioned into looking up an ex-girlfriend on Facebook, and I found out that she was having a good time without me. And that, for whatever reason, spiraled me. And I thought, I need to escape. And I couldn't get anything. I was like out of options in terms of synthetically changing the way that I feel. So the next best idea was to go outside, climb the tree, which is about 2 or 3 stories, and then jump out with the intention not to really harm myself, but I felt like if I could break my legs, I could get a couple months at a hospital or some sort of facility and kind of figure out what's going on next. And so I climbed the tree, and it was tall. It was a high-pitched roof, you know, 12-12. It was, you know, good size. And on the way down, I got scared. And I don't really know, like, I don't know how you break your legs without breaking anything else. I didn't. So if anybody has any ideas, but I got scared and absorbed the fall, hurt my back. And the people were like, what is this guy? So people came out rushing. I enjoyed the attention. And they called the ambulance. And I remember laying there and being slightly disappointed that I didn't injure myself more than I had planned. And my back hurt, but I more or less felt okay. It was startling if anything else. And so I'm kind of like leaning into it. You know, I'm kind of like, oh, man. And I can hear the paramedics kind of figuring out, like, hey, where should we take him? And I remember hearing, like, well, we can go to Ocala, but he may need to be airlifted to, I think, Bannon Point. That's a place, like, north of Newport Beach. It'd be something. And I heard that, and I was like, oh, I really got to sell this. So then they're doing this assessment, and they're like, hey, sir, can you feel your feet? And I was like, oh, I can't. And then we're touching him up. Oh, I can't. We got to airlift him. So I ended up getting airlifted. Thank you. That's the ball part. I don't know what Jared likes about that story. I hope I told it right. But I don't know, dude. I was just a loony tune. I feel like the neat thing about AA is that the experience that it gives me, and as I sponsor guys and meet friends in AA and go to meetings, it's really cool, exciting, that every person that I've met in AA lived an entire movie each day. And although generally it was not good, it's we're I don't know. It's pretty amazing that we ended up here. And I think that that's like I look back on my daily life, and at the time it was pretty horrendous. The people that I hurt, the family, like, you know, I would have family members in the beginning fly down to Florida and like pick me up from jail and like invest a lot of time and money, and I would dodge them and go get crack cocaine and smoke it, and then basically say, fuck off, like, I'm not doing this. I'm like, watch my dad, who I adore, just burst in tears and be like, you're a junkie, you know, like, say, it was just like, it was pretty bad. I got to the point at the end where, you know, I was like living at my grandma's house because she was my enabler, God bless her. She looks at it positively. I think that she's a little, like, she's kind of going through dementia a little bit, but it was pretty shitty. And I was living there, and I think I was journaling about this today, and I was, each night, if I had the opportunity to actually get whatever I needed to turn this off, it would run out. My gum is like going down my throat right now. It would like, I was trying to continue to speak and I'm choking on. I would get this, I would get whatever I needed, and it would run out, as it always does, unfortunately. And, you know, it'd be at some point in the middle of the night, and then I'd have this, honestly before, but when it finally ran out, I would have this overwhelming weight that there's nothing else to do right now. And I would just sit with this, like, physical feeling of, like, shit, right? And then I would dream, and I would imagine what I'm going to do tomorrow, you know? I'd say, okay, well, tomorrow this is my plan. I'm going to wake up, and I'm going to eat something. And I'm going to go do whatever positive task that I would do. And I would make these commitments, especially towards the end. I was fed up with what was around me. I mean, I was, like, really at a low spot. And I would make these plans to go and do big things. Get a job. Steak and Shake was like across the street. Like, that was my arc. I was like, man, one day I'm gonna have a job at Steak and Shake. And if you work at Steak and Shake, I'm not dissing. I'm just saying that was like, if you could dream anything, you'd probably dream something bigger than Steak and Shake. My dream was Steak and Shake. And I would wake up and I didn't have a choice on what I wanted to do. And that was tough. And it sucks that it took like 7-8 years of heavy cocaine and alcohol abuse. But the first time I felt that, nothing changed. Weeks into feeling that, nothing changed. A couple more rests into that, it didn't change. I would go to bed at some point after a day of really disgusting decisions, and I would make promises to myself. And when I woke up, no matter how much I wanted to do those things, I didn't have a choice. And that kind of sucked. Ended up in Daco, and which now is the Cove, but at ADOG Daco, guys, I see you. Yes? No one raised their hand. And I can say that as excited I was to get that chance, I went there fully, so like I was getting arrested quite frequently the last few years, so I had multiple violations of probations, and Judge Perry was the judge who I had frequently seen on every other violation, send people up the road for their original offense. I was fully committed to go to prison for whatever time I had remaining after time served. In fact, I was completely okay with it there. I didn't really have much else going on. I assumed that, you know, the one thing I was upset about was I heard that you weren't able to smoke in prison, and it was a new change that had happened when I was kind of on the fence. So that was probably my biggest, what I was most upset about. He ended up sending me to Daco out of some miracle on the fourth violation. And as excited as I was to get out scot-free, my confidence level in my ability to actually do something with that opportunity was low, because at this point I had been to 11 or 12 treatment facilities, whether they were the nice ones or the shitty ones. And it was cool to, like, you know, have an opportunity. It was definitely more comfortable than being sent to a facility or jail. But I knew the song and dance, so I can get through a couple weeks of, like, the intake. I was really good at that. But I fully accepted that I would eventually llama, or they say leave AMA in Tampa, but I called it, I like the llama. I don't know if you want to write that down. And so I don't know, like, hey Zach, what changed? You're pretty screwed up. Like, how'd you do it? Dude, I don't know. I didn't do anything differently than I did the other dozen times that I was in treatment, or the promises that I made in jail. You know, right before you get out, you're like, man, I'm going to get involved in this Bible group in jail. We're going to sing songs. And then, you know, a week before your exit date, you know, you start getting those ideas. And I couldn't even explain it. I would, like, hear someone, like, eating lunch in the hall talk about weed. I didn't like weed, but I'd get this idea, you know, I don't know. So my confidence level was low, but I remember they elevate you. There's, like, tiers in terms of, like, how much they trust you. And you'd get a badge, and you'd have little stickers on them. And that's how they graded your value at Dino. And at the third sticker, which I believe was red, you were able to walk to the Dollar General and get items. So you were... And Dollar General was a place that I frequently stole from when I was in a pinch to do whatever. Like, there's whatever. You can use anything for anything. And I remember being really excited, and on the way over there, I had walked that road a ton of times, brother, in terms of just strolling in to do something else, and then I get that, and I'm like, I'm going to go rob this place and take all the things that I rob and try to feel better. And so I remember walking up, and I had this thought of a distant whisper that said, what if you didn't do that? And I probably heard that before, and I don't know what happened, but I blacked out, and I left, and I didn't take anything. So not a thief anymore, but also more important, like, I remember walking back after, I literally don't remember being inside the store, but I'm sure I got groceries, but I walked back, and it was the first time that I had ever thought about not making a bad decision and actually not make the bad decision. And I don't know if that means anything, but for me, it was like, it was something. It was a brick. I mean, you build house brick by brick. You got to lay the concrete. And that was the repo bar for the concrete. I don't know. Bad analogy, but I went to DACO, and it was pretty crazy. I mean, they would, like, smoke spice in the bathroom. We weren't allowed to smoke cigarettes, but they couldn't stop us from smoking cigarettes. We'd smoke them in the bathroom with the guys smoking spice. So there was, like, a constant power struggle between them not allowing us legally to smoke cigarettes, but if they didn't let us go outside to smoke, then we just smoke up the entire building. And that was fun. I felt like Brad Pitt and Troy, if you've ever seen that. Slightly less athletic and pale. And I think that was my experience at DACO. I remember, what time did I stop? Am I good on time? I'm just flowing. I don't even know what I'm talking about. I remember, you know, when I sponsor guys, I feel like, and this was me, but I feel like there's a rush. Like, all those nights that I was, like, laying in bed, out of drugs, out of booze, and just thinking about, I'd typically scroll Facebook, this was pre-Instagram, and I'd see, like, friends that I have, and, or things happening in the community, and I would make these plans that were never fulfilled, but I'd have these ideas about the day that I stopped drinking, which seemed so far away, and I remember, and this is something that my sponsees go through, but me as well, is that once I started to feel good, I had a Rolodex of pre-made plans that I had made for my life. I need to get my career on track. I had never had a job, but my best friend went to this college. I should probably go back to school. I need a girlfriend right now. I need to get in shape. So I need to do some research on like how are my testosterone levels, like what kind of steroids can I take? I'm not trying to go to the gym. And there is a level of intensity in terms of how quickly these things should happen. And these are all, again, coming from a guy that I've trained myself to only try to make myself feel better. Now that alcohol, okay, I guess I'm not going to drink anymore. I'm kind of buying into this thing. I'm instantly grabbing onto this idea that if I achieve these things, then we're good. We got this. And I remember getting released from DACO, or getting allowed to be released from DACO after 4 months, and being extremely terrified, because while I was, the handcuffs were off, so to speak, and they were like, hey man, you know, based on your parole or probation or whatever the terms you have, you're allowed to leave at this point or coming up. I had no idea how any of that would apply to actually being out and living. Like, I didn't feel like I had any skills at all. But there was also this intensity inside of myself that I had to get my life started. I don't think you understand. I am 24 years old. I'm basically dead in the next midlife. And things better start happening ASAP. And I remember, I don't know, some old guy at a meeting was talking about if we just kind of like let that stuff like pause it for a minute and address the entire reason that we can't stop drinking, that we might have a chance. And this guy had a lot of money, and I was like, well, all right, so let me like take a listen to what this guy says. And I ended up staying for 3 more months, and what was suggested to me from my temporary sponsor was that I build a routine. That's a secret. That was my secret. I ended up doing 7 or 8 months in DACO, and then I went through the steps. But I will say that for me, the reason that the routine is so vital is that I have another routine that I've trained, that I've drilled into myself. And there's this old guy, Bob, that used to say, I can't think my way into right acting. I have to act my way into right thinking. I don't even know if he made that up. I don't know. But he's old, and so it seems like something that he might do in 15 minutes. I can do it in 5. So it was interesting to me to start to think about me doing things that I don't feel like doing. I would call my temporary sponsor, and I would spend 25 minutes selling him on an idea as to why DACO isn't really operating the way that I think it should be going. They're not really not going to enough meetings, and they're also not going to the right meetings. And he would listen to me, and I would tell him my plan that you know, I in fact also wanted to open up a rehab facility because I feel like it's my mission now that I have this newfound sobriety to really impact other people. And there's a lot of guys out there. I'm unique in the sense that my story is a little different than the ones that I've heard, so it might be valuable to open up another facility for people like me. Listen to me talk about that. And then you say, cool, I want you to do this, and I'd say, cool. So that doesn't actually address my concerns. And then you listen to me, and so that was my introduction. And a lot of what I go to the men's Keep It Simple group Friday night, 8:15, Yana, probably the best meeting after YPG in the Portico. And no women are allowed there, but it's really been a foundational part of my program is I'm constantly looking at the world and my surroundings with a bias that I'm continually trying to clean. And the best thing that I can do is the next right action. And it sounds silly. It sounded silly to me as a newcomer. But generally, what's going on up here is not quite reality. So anyways, I got a sponsor. Let me get into the steps here. I got a sponsor, and we immediately got into step one. Maybe you've heard of it. And I don't think that I had an issue with recognizing that alcohol was a problem based on my record. I wasn't ignorant to that fact, but I didn't quite understand. I think I mentioned it before, but I really truly believe that if I just stopped drinking, I had enough good ideas to really get my life back on track. And there was a disconnect between alcohol not really being my problem, just being a temporary solution, and me being the problem. And the way that he drilled that into me was, we went through a life story, and he just pointed out essentially every bad decision that I ever made. And a lot of them weren't really alcohol-related. I was just pretty bad at being a manager. I was just generally a bad decision maker as a whole. And most decisions that I made were beneficial to me and totally ignorant of anybody else around me. I was looking through life as if I was the center. And he, you know, went to the 12 and 12 and pointed out that I have a devastating weakness. Until I accept that, I will never have a chance of sobriety. And then he would do this thing where he would ask me to define certain words that were obvious. And so he'd say, "What does devastating mean?" I'm like, I'm terrible. "Yeah, but why do you think they chose devastating?" And I say, "I don't know, Bill was a really good writer. I guess in the 40s that was a popular word." And we would look up that word. I remember this, we looked up that word, and then he would give me examples of when that word might be used. He would say, "Do you think a head-on collision with a family of four dying would be devastating?" And I'm like, "Yeah, that's terrible. Why would you even bring that up?" He's like, "And then go on with these more traumatic experiences, or these traumatic examples." That's the word that they chose to describe our this disease. It's devastating. And the point that he was trying to make is that I'm completely fucked. Like, I have no chance. Like, it would be an absolute miracle. And he's like sitting there, like really beating me down. I went through my whole life story. I'm really sad. And he's just continuing to hammer this idea that my problem and my situation is worse. That it was worse than I'm even able to comprehend. Like, it's like it might be bad, but you don't even understand how bad it is. And the hole that you have to dig to get out of here is too much for you to do. And I was like, "Okay, cool. That's like, so like, should I just get off? Like, that doesn't sound very good." And then he goes to step two, and he talks about the hope and all that stuff. The interesting thing about step two for me was, like, the God stuff is whatever. I think at this point in my journey, my current thesis or my current theory on the God stuff is that even if you believe in God, it still has to change. If I come in here with no good ideas, and I have no good ideas, and so even if, you know, like, I came in Christian, and I was like, "Christian is the way." And if you are Christian or not, like, that's just how I came in. My grandfather was a pastor, and I have a whole history. We were like the Sunday people. We never talked about God, but we went every Sunday as if it was like, and I came in very stout and proud of that, and I was like, "This is the way." And that even that had to be reshaped. But what I really found interesting was the idea that I could be restored to sanity. And what exactly does restoration mean? Am I like 10 minutes in? I'm getting actually pretty long-winded and stuff. Okay, cool. Is restoration. In my example, like how my brain processes this is if you were to find a car buried in the lake and it had been there for 20 years. For me, it was an Acura NSX 1997 Target Top on extreme, 6-speed manual with a V6. Your car could be anything, honestly. And I would watch these guys like do these restorations on these cars, and they'd find in these random barns or whatever. And my sponsor, you know, would say things like, you know, "Hey, do you think they're going to do that? Do you think that they're, oh yeah, they absolutely, well, what they have to do is remove the panels and do this, and they got to pull the engine out and probably re-sleeve it and change the exhaust, the tires are probably rotted." And he's like, "So that's you. Like you're that car. You've been unattended and left to die for your entire life. And most of what you're coming into the room with is garbage. And so do you believe, as you do with this YouTube channel, that you can be restored in the same way that they're restoring that car?" And being that I can only think of analogies, I said, "That makes total sense." There are some good qualities about me that can be invested in, but generally, aside from the frame, everything's got to go. And that was our transition to step three. I had an issue with this idea of God's will. Is it God's will that I'm here tonight? Is it God's will that I wake up tomorrow and take a shower? Should I be brushing my teeth before my coffee, or should I be brushing my teeth after my coffee? Both? After, really? I've been brushing them before. So you're constantly letting go of old ideas. And with this religious like presence that I came into, I really, like, God's will. I also didn't like the third step prayer. It was a lot of vows and dots and thoughts and whatever. But the God's will concept was very abstract to me. So what my sponsor did was he had me define what I thought God was, you know, at my adolescence and sobriety. And so we went through that, and he kind of learned a lot about my beliefs and where I thought, and it was a very judgmental God, and yada, 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 yada. Do it with your sponsor if you're interested. But then we talked about that, and, you know, this idea, you know, in Bill's story, and as Abby, like, choose your own concept, we adopted that to a certain point of me Build-A-Bearing my God. And I was like, well, you know, it'd be cool if he didn't judge me for making mistakes. Cool, write it down. Okay, he's kind, he's loving. Is he patient with you? And I was like, well, I'm patient. All this stuff. I heard this guy, Dan, in a meeting speak, and he said, it was a meeting about forgiveness. And everyone kind of shifted into this forgiveness aspect of how we ask for forgiveness from our higher power, God, if you choose to call it that. And Dan, who I respected, very quiet guy, didn't say a lot. He raised his hand at the end, and he said, I never found the reason to ask forgiveness from something that I'm not judged from in the first place. And I was like, whoa. So I wrote that down. I was like, favored, unconditional love. And the way that we applied that to step three, someone's phone is at 10%, just thought you should know. Uber receipts. Someone ordered Uber in here. Whose phone is it? The way that we applied that was, if this is a program of action, and each, you know, I have thousands of choices a day, there's no way that was already 5 minutes. I gotta wrap this up. It's gonna be a step through me. Is that at any given moment, I can look at this concept of my God that I've worked with a sponsor on and describe this thing that I've been told to give my life to. And if my behavior in this moment is aligned with those characteristics, then there's a good chance I'm in God's will. And so I would like, I had this job at 2J's Cafe downtown, and it was like a 4-hour-a-day job. It was literally the easiest job that I could have, and it was surprising. And it was stressful for me to show up on time. I didn't get enough smoke breaks, and I had to wear gloves when I smoke because it gets on your fingers. So that was really inconvenient. And I would go to the bathroom frequently. They had really good restroom receptacles, and they're extremely close to where we work, so I was able to get a lot of breaks in. And I'd call him because he would tell me, call me whenever you're disturbed. And I'd say, okay, I'm going to do that. I'm going to get honest about my feelings. And I would call him, and I would call him, and it was really interesting to see, A, how I viewed every single issue that I'm having that was uncomfortable as the world's worst emergency, but also, it was like, cool, man, here's what I want you to do. And he was like essentially training like my brain to, you know, my general response in traffic was to double fist. Is this recorded video? I would double finger, drive with the wheel, and shout obscenities out the window. And I would wonder, why am I so disturbed? Like, this is crazy. It's their fault. And there was little actions of like, hey, you're actually a really bad driver. Do you think that mother of two in the car with the little baby stickers on the back might be going to something important that's more important than where you're going? You know, he opened my eyes, and it essentially didn't really matter what I thought, but he gave me an action. I don't want you to flick anybody off today. I'd like for you not to use your horn. That was the simplicity of my early sobriety. Was, you know, I was talking to Chris about this. This is a fun one that we went through, and it was, I'll finish with this because I'm getting too long on this road. Honesty was like a really big part of my program early on, and still, my sponsor today, still, at 12 years, he's like, you know, like, we still talk about the importance of honesty as a foundation. If we're building a house, that's like the piece. And the irony is that I didn't quite know how to be honest. I liked the idea of it, and I would be honest in a pinch. You know, I'd have all these things that I needed to get honest about, and I'd be like, well, no, listen, here's the honesty truth, and I'd be like hiding this so that you'd think I was an honest person. Just enough to get by. And my first sponsor, when he took me through the steps, he would have me call him anytime I was disturbed. And that was how he taught me to be honest, was by talking about, what are you worried about today? Because for me, that was the crux of the beginning of my bad decisions. I'm really worried about this problem. I don't feel quite right about it. And then I'm going to do a really crazy, I'm going to make a really crazy decision to try to make myself feel better so I can solve this problem that I have no business solving. And that's, what's my point? Hey, listen, guys. My point is, I was really stressed out today for an unrelated issue, that reason. And I was writing out all my problems, and then you know, kind of going through, I'm like, wow, I'm absolutely crazy. And your problem is worse than you think it is. But on the other side, if even now, at any point, I feel like if I were to write down what I'd like my life to be like, dreams, typically it's like material stuff, you know, but if I were to write down everything that I want, I guarantee that had I done that year one or early sobriety or DACO, I would have sold myself short. The gifts of this program, by doing those first three steps, but there's nine more, we'll talk about it, and really taking a different action, working with someone, working with sponsees, taking out the tools that I was currently using to live life and slowly being willing to replace them with different tools and use those different tools. All the other stuff that I thought I wanted happened, but for me, everything that I searched for in alcohol and bulimia and cocaine and duster spray, if you're into that, everything that I was hoping to achieve, I guess it's just like being okay with just being okay, happened. And the irony is that when I do get something cool, you know, a promotion or a girlfriend, which it does happen, you know, whatever kind of like material item or cool accomplishment, I learned to snowboard or whatever, I'm in a position where I can actually appreciate it and actually enjoy it. And the gifts of this program have been like, I think just as I wasn't able to comprehend how bad it was, I don't think I'm able to even comprehend how good it's gotten. Because, you know, it's a daily fight for me to be able to continue to go and seek out this higher power who gives me everything that I need. So, you know, if you're on the fence about doing it, just do it, brother. And I hope you guys got anything out of that. But I do appreciate you asking me to speak, and I'll wrap it up there. Thanks.